Yeah. And to me, if you see it at the major league level now, that you'll see the one or two good coaches that you have around you, surround yourself with guys, because when you're managing the game, there's so much going on, you cannot follow everything. I coached 4 years at the major league level, two with Chuck Tanner at Pittsburgh, and two with Fregosi when I was with the Angels. And Jim was just getting started, you know. So DeRocher coached a few years when I was at the Dodgers. Bobby Bregan coached 1 year over there. So you had different personalities. And coaches, when you're a coach for the manager and when you're the manager of a team, it's two different entities. I mean, you're the focal point, what goes on, or you're just the guy laying in the weeds, you know, and that type of thing. So we had good coaching, had good organization. All the things we did in spring training, where I learned all my baseball to go into managing or coaching when I was playing in the minor leagues. I mean, I took sliding lessons, I guess, for sliding. I worked rundowns. I knew what outfield relay plays were, pickoff plays. You did the whole thing. And you had game critique with the manager. He'd go over the game, how it was played, who made a mistake, what mistakes you had. And if you paid attention, you learned every facet of the game. You know, and nowadays the pitchers, you know, they don't want to pay attention to what's going on, and you need to know if you want to stay in the ball game. So all those things that you learn, the player was, I think, better qualified when he got there than now. The younger player plays with a college coach or high school, and he goes to the minor leagues, and he doesn't have that knowledge. I see more miscues, mental miscues, at the major league level, and here the manager's suffering, and he's embarrassed by, here's a major league player with maybe about a total of 3 years experience, and maybe one of a full year in the major leagues, and he makes him. I saw a terrible rundown play in Boston. Somebody threw the ball late, and the guy, Dodgers, Piazza and Wallach, gave him the ball late, and then when he caught the ball, the guy ran into him because he's in his line, and he didn't catch the ball. And that's the play you work on in spring training. So, I mean, I imagine both of them know how to do it better, but it's not practice as much. When I went to Detroit, Pat Mullen was a hitting coach. Stubby Overmeyer was a pitching coach. Stubby played with Newhouser. All he used to tell was Newhouser stories, Hal Newhouser story. So Charlie pretty much ran the club. Charlie's a good baseball man. I was impressed with his knowledge of the game. He knew how to make a lineup up, that's a lot of things that I learned, how to set your lineup to where, you know, you have your best hitter hitting, just like the Giants, why they made the move when they got Strawberry. Even though Strawberry wasn't, to me, physically that good a player right now, the threat, when you moved Bonds to third and Matt Williams to fourth, just turned that whole ball club around. So
certainly did.
And you learn that part about it. And Mayo Smith, I didn't get to know much about. Johnny Sain is a good pitching coach. John was... You worked in a little bit different. You had to get to know John a little bit. Even though he was very good, you had to warm up to him rather than he warmed up to you. But he was very good. The 2 years that I, actually in the minor leagues, when I worked for the White Sox, but when I worked for Pittsburgh, I learned a lot of baseball from Danny Murtaugh. And my roommate was John Lippon, ex-Detroit shortstop. And he was telling me about infield play. And eventually this is what helped me in managing. To me about that when he came back out of the service, he had hurt his arm, and he talked to Boudreau over at Cleveland, and he said that Boudreau shortened up to about 5.5-6 steps behind the baseline, you know, where from second to third, because he couldn't throw anymore toward the end, and he would dive and catch balls and throw guys out. It looked great. If he played deeper and fielded balls in the hole, he couldn't throw anybody out anyway. So Lippon started doing the same thing. So more base hits went by you, but you feel it and made the plays.
Sure.
So, you know, this is what you... Because both of them were good offensive players.
Right.
And so you learn that part, you know, about the game. Danny was about as sharp as it was about the game. I liked the way Danny Mangino handled his players. And he had good people around him. Maybe he didn't, you know all the names, you know, the people, but yeah. Catcher named George Latour, I think his name is in organization. But Skinner is a good hitting coach. Joe L. Brown was a general manager, and I kind of talking to Joe about it, whatever. He kept bringing Danny back, and I think that might have been what killed him, because he wasn't in good health. he'd fire a manager and bring Danny back. And he did it about two, three times. Actually, when Tanner got the job in 77, Danny died that winter in 76. But it's some guys that you meet, you know, along the line, admire. And just to give you an example, is that I was on the minor league. I was going to manage the minor league club. I just had been let go by Chicago, and I was in early spring training, and they had meetings, and Danny would sit, everyone faced this way, and Danny would sit behind you. So in order to talk, you know, you'd turn around, and he'd say, no, you talk to the general manager up front. But he would watch everybody, see in the meeting, see what was going on. And he asked me to make a list of who I thought the 10 best pitchers on the Pittsburgh staff was. And I listed two guys, Jim Mitchell and Sam McDowell, who physically was, this is before he changed his lifestyle. And they asked why I put his name down. I said, these are the only two guys you got on the staff and out of the bullpen of all the names that are on there can strike somebody out with less than two out with a runner on third base. And I guess that impressed Danny because of the reason, you know, being a relief pitcher. Mm-hmm. And the minor league started and everything else. I had to go to every major league meeting because he felt I had something to offer. It was just that one thing. So all the other guys that were in the minor, even the son was a minor league manager. He didn't come to the meetings, but they'd find me and make me go to the meetings, you know. And I asked him, well, I don't see the club anymore. What does he want me? Well, when I was there, I could watch the ball club. He says, you might have something to offer. And he just felt if you, you know, that if you thought you were knowledgeable, it was good. So these are guys that were in baseball a long time, you know, that did a good job. Fregosi was 36 or 7. He was at Pittsburgh when, that's a funny thing there, when Tanner was managing the club. And
that's right. It was his last stop, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was playing. Uh-huh. And so we were down to the last three, four guys, and we were on the coaching staff again, and we were picking our utility guys. And I kept putting Fregosi's name down. And Tanner says, you keep putting Fregosi down. He had Gonzalez, a couple other guys, you know. So I said, yeah, I think against left-handed, he's the best right-hand pitcher that he got. He's got all the patience. You know, and he still can hit the ball. He can't throw, and he run fairly good, you know, whatever this and that. So he makes the ball club, and so as we're going on the plane back, I said to him, is it all right if I stay with one of the players? Because, you know, being a coach, we were in get apartment together. Mm-hmm. So he says, no wonder you kept putting his name there. But anyway, halfway through the season, he got the Angel job. And, you know, and eventually we got together in the coach. Not that I wanted to leave Tanner, but Anaheim's 12 miles from home. And I figured, you know, that's, you know, a good deal. We won the first year at 79, and with the team. But he didn't handle the press real well, and the next year they just ate him alive. And we had a bad season, some injuries. And anyway, when he got back now at Philadelphia, I was glad to see him do a good job. He just handled it a lot better. He's a good baseball man to me.
Yeah, I was not impressed at first, but I think he did a really good job here last year with the Phillies.
Yeah.
Unless I'm a Philly fan.
If you look at the club and you know what he did with the players and you know how he juggled his lineup and whatever. Now, that tells you how bad the club went this year with the amount of injuries and how much, you know, their staff went down and their, you know, Kruk being out for a while, Dykstra again, you know. But they lost, their pitching. And try to win the pennant with a guy like Williams.
Well, I think he's done an even better job this year than last year because, like I said, he's had so many injuries. And he's kept them at, I think until recently, right about 500, you know. And that was pretty incredible with the pitchers. He's been, you know, I don't know where he's been finding these guys. He's been pulling people out of the stands.
Well, Valenzuela they signed. Yeah. And he made the other guy into a starter, I think.
Yeah, West in and all that sort of stuff.
And the one guy just pitched, just his first came back, didn't it? Who is it? He just got back.
Schilling just came back, right. Let's talk a little bit about your pitching. How would you describe yourself as a pitcher, Larry?
Well,
what
I would say.
Of pitcher were you? You mentioned your fastball and your slider. Was that
pretty much would die? I had a good curveball, but when I get into the bullpen. And I used it a little bit more over the American League, but the National League, I'd pretty much using the fastball and the slider because of when you warm up and you try to limit your number of pitches and how quickly you have to get ready, the curveball is more of a, to me, physically to throw it. It's a harder pitch to use, and takes more muscles and to be more exact with it. And when you're in a hurry, you got to get two pitches. One, you know, I teach relief pitchers and tell them the only way you're going to pitch in the major leagues is if you throw hard, you better have one other pitch that you can get over beside the fastball. Otherwise, you won't pitch very long there. And every big league pitcher has. Smith is now suffering a little bit with some home runs, but he's got a pretty good little breaking ball, too. Or like Franco had a pretty good slider, and he learned to turn the ball over. I see that Montgomery's got a good breaking ball.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what you have to have beside the one fastball. But you have to come in and throw one of the first two pitches over the plate and out of the middle. And so that you have one strike on the hitter on the first two pitches. If you don't, when you come in and pitch a relief, you will not be successful. You have to get that done. So you got to have some guts to come in no matter who's hitting and challenge with the first or second pitch. If you're going to watch guys pitch and get behind 3-0 and then 3-1 trying to get guys out, you're going to get burned because the better hitter is going to sit on you until he gets his pitch. And you got to know what hitters, you know, will do that in the good tight situation, will not worry about chasing a bad ball, you know. And this is what you have to be able to do. So my style of pitching was dictated to that role. And once I got away from the starting rotation, I got away from using a curveball. I developed a change dressing, working with a change at the beginning of 58. But then once I lost the starting role, the change of speed pitch was not something that I should have kept up with it and worked on and developed a little bit more. You know.
You can answer this either both ways or one way, but what was your strategy with your on an 0-2 pitch? We mentioned before, because you mentioned that back in the old days, a lot of times at the 0-2, they'd knock you right down. Was that yours?
A lot of writers used to ask me, what did you throw? And I said, well, when I stopped throwing a curveball, I said, I threw fastball, slider, knockdown. That's the first pitches, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's the first thought that I would do is knock somebody down, two strikes, no ball. And left-hand hitters, Drysdale in spring training, that I didn't do it. He could do it a little bit more than I did. He'd throw at their back knee. And used to hit a lot of left-hand hitters, throw the fastball. The left knee, when the guy strides, the left knee's planted. Left leg's planted. The front leg, the guy can move or get out of the way. And you throw at their back leg, both feet got to come out from under him. And Don was as good as I've ever seen that. You know, because he created the angle from out here across, you know. So it was, you know, but this is what you did. You moved the idea of what you're doing is moving him from his batting stance. For the guy to take his batting stance and stride through, take the pitch with an aggressive type position. Now he gets back again. Here comes the next pitch, you know. If you can visualize, you know, you see what I'm saying. When the guy strides and has to move from his hitting position, has to get back in the box, regroup, find where he wants to stand, okay. The plate, 16, 17 inch plate, all of a sudden this becomes a little bit more of a mental thing. So you're playing with a guy. And you'd be surprised at 60 feet. You can see right into their eyes, and you can see who you can intimidate. Example, first time he came up, you see, Rose used to run to first base when he walked, you know. First time that I pitched, first or second time I pitched him, Cincinnati, boy, I knocked him real good, hitting left hand. He got back up, dusted himself, I took a good cut, hit a line drive, made an out, run down, made a turn first, and I said, looked around like that. I said, yeah, he's probably going to be here for a while. But I mean, just to evaluate the guy, hey, he didn't show. He maybe bothered and threw at him, but he didn't make any emotion about it. And he went about his business, wasn't visibly shaken about it, you know.
Didn't lose his concentration.
No, he wasn't going to let me see that he was bothered by it.
Right. So. How would you describe your pitching motion to those of us out there who didn't see you?
Before I hurt my arm, I pretty much, where I had control problems, is that it was pretty much, you know, the big wind-up motion. I used to say it looked like I was falling out of a tree. You know, after I'd hurt my arm, I went to Detroit, I went to a no windup because I went to more of control for my breaking ball and with the slider to be a little bit more effective. So it didn't give me as much deception as I had when I first came out. I think that was part of my deception. The one thing that my brother told me in Roseboro said on a given day is he didn't have the speed gun. On a given day, outside of Colfax, because he was about 4 miles, 5 miles faster than everybody else. But Williams, Drysdale, Padre in that group on a given day, I threw as good as any of those four, because I had a lot of movement. And my movement, which I learned to use, is that my fastball worked the opposite direction of most guys' fastball. Tail is this way. I cut my fastball like a running cut fastball or cut slide. And after a year or so, I think it was, Drysdale come to me and sat down over a couple of drinks and just more or less raking me over the call. Pick my mind. McCovey hit about 180 off of me, and he hit 900 off of Drysdale. Now, you've got to understand, Drysdale's fastball tails back this way. McCovey's swing is an inside-out
right
swing.
Right.
I've seen him more home runs over our bullpen
right, yeah.
in left field, and left center.
That's right.
Yeah. And then when he tried to throw the breaking ball, okay, my fastball cut this way. And I'd pitched against McCovey in the minor leagues, and I think that might have been a little bit. I threw the ball. I could get the ball above the waist, and then I threw it directly over the top curveball to him. And if it was breaking real good, those two pitches gave him fits. And he could not turn this ball out because it ran in. And, you know, both of us threw right-handed, but we had different deliveries. And I'd come in, you know, to pitch, break his bat or something. You know, I don't think Don could ever do that.
The kids in San Francisco used to hop out of the bleachers when he used to bat against Drysdale.
And wait for the ball.
Right. Yeah, you'd see him make about 50 from running out. The figure got right, yeah. And that's the difference, you know. But Don, against right-handers, Don was more intimidating. I threw from a higher position, what you'd call 1 o'clock or this way. The slider was a one equalizer that he'd get going away. But Don was intimidating because he threw so far across his body that he hit the ball for so long. You know, Ewell Blackwell type mm-hmm. type of delivery. You know, and so that was the one effect. So, but my curveball gave me a little bit more edge against left-handers than Don. Don threw a little bit of a changeup. It just that surprising, as big as he was, he had, when he was on, had really excellent control, with his fastball. Mm-hmm. Could hit the outside corner on left-handers and could get the ball in on left-handers. And he wasn't afraid to throw inside, even at left-hand hitters.
Let's talk about some of the catchers you play, because catchers obviously have a lot to do with certain pitchers' career.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned what your brother was able to do with Sandy Koufax. And talk about your brother Norm a little bit and the advantage of growing up with him and his, you know, some of the insights he provided you. And then you also play with Roseboro, Pignatano, Bill Freehan.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little about some of their contributions. Hopefully they were positive to your career.
I say when my brother and I, when I pitched to him at the major league level, we played 1 year, 58, in the minor leagues together. We played winter ball one season together, and the 3 years, 60, 61, 62, which is the last brother battery in baseball. I don't know what the Topps card's worth now. I don't know, maybe $8, $10 or something. But, I mean, to me, I feel I'm pretty proud of that. There's not been all that many, you know, in a while. There's been brothers that have played mm-hmm. together, father and son a lot now, but not, battery mates. And the one game that I recall after when he got traded to the Mets, and we'd clinched the pennant in 63, I had not been getting a lot of weeks, so they started me against the Mets. So the first time that he came up, their guys from the bench were yelling at me to knock him down. And the Dodger guys, my teammates, are yelling for Norm to hit one out. See? Because the pennant, you know, was, so I think I walked him and he flied out. And then he yelled out at me. He said, he's taking his spring. He says, "Don't you hit me." He says, "Mom will be mad at you." Something like that. So I had to put my glove up in front of my face to keep him laughing. Now, here's a major league game, you know, going on, and, you know, we're carrying on a little banding around conversation, there are some lighter moments. But as far as him being a help, I remember when I got traded in 64, and my delivery got off a little bit, and I was kind of slinging the ball. I'd had an injury to my arm, and so he lived up in Burbank, and he didn't report that spring for some reason, spring training. I don't know why. He got traded from the Mets and to Buffalo, and he wasn't going to go or something. I don't know. I was the last year, I think, 63 with the Mets. And so he was catching me, and he was working with my delivery. I wasn't throwing. So I'd got traded, and I took about a week before I reported back to Detroit. They were the season hadn't started yet, and so he worked with some things. So I started the 64 season and found something in my delivery and worked with me. So and then I used to still work out at Dodger Stadium in the spring, 65, 66, 67. I got permission for me to go down. You know, they have the workouts. They started doing that. When you get over 30 years old, is you get the edge on the 20-year-old. If you don't come down with your arm in shape in spring training, you're behind. You know, so physically, I want to be ready to be ahead, so I always worked out. So he caught me, worked with me. Roseboro, expression-wise, the Gabby never said much. Expression-wise is the eyes. Had to tape his fingers at night in some of the parks because you could, black, okay, I couldn't not see. And he used the slider, he gave the signs this way, but with one and two, sometimes, so he used to put tape on his fingers. But I've noticed, remember mostly in the games I pitched it, when I made certain type of pitches, the expression of his eyes looking through the mat. Everybody's got a different expression. Piggy was more outspoken, very vocal, very nervous it isn't going to be right. He always comes out to the mound because if he did something, and he's, I know, Piggy, go on back. So, I was a young pitcher then, so he felt that was his responsibility. Freehanded just got to the big leagues and was not, the physical part of his game was good as far as his catching, blocking balls. As far as calling the game, I didn't think it was real good. He was coming out of college. He was a good offensive player. I think he hit 300 his first year. And, that was his first year. So a couple times that I think I pitched, and I come in to pitch, and the Killer was over at Minnesota, a small park over there. And I says, the balls I'm getting up inside, he says, yeah, I said, I was asking him because I didn't know about the hitters, And he says, well, it doesn't look like you're throwing real hard. So I said, don't you ever tell me that. Going back after the ball game, I said, don't you ever come out of mind and tell me I'm not throwing hard. Tell me I put the ball in a different place, So he didn't know those things. I pitched a little bit differently, he didn't know. I says, you know what this means? When you give a sign, that's to knock somebody down, He didn't have that sign. I said, well, you better start thinking about it. So, those things. But as the years went by, he pretty much knew what I wanted to do, situations, that he had. Of course, he had Joe Sparma.
Yes.
And
sure.
Good strong arm, and McLean, Lolich. And Mickey was a piece of work. He's, left-handed guys. I think left-handers think differently than somebody, But we had, good young Nukos' staff there. And this is a ball club that Dressen built. The team that won in 68, was a team that he put together. He cried when he sent Horton out in 64. I sent him out because he loved Horton.
He's a good ball player.
Yeah, but in 64, he just got off to a bad start. Gates Brown was on the club.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, Gates says to me, sitting on the bullpen in Yankee Stadium, he said, when you get traded, you kind of ease in the meeting the guys. You don't jump right. And he said, I listened to you. He said, you pitched in the series. He says, I was in my cell. I was listening to games. I said, where? He said, he's 2 years in Ohio State Penitentiary. Yeah. So I said, what for? He says, I'm following some other guys around. They were breaking and entering or whatever, he says that they scouted, somebody scouted him in prison, he, to me, this guy, youthful guy, just followed somebody, not enough sense to know any better, and good thing he had a baseball background, to fall back on, and Northrop, they called him the Gray Fox, and Cash and Cam. It was just a building, great club. McAuliffe, Jerry Lumpy was there the first year. Donnie Wirt, a little bit underrated ball player. And we had Ray Orler. Jackie Moore was the other catcher. A guy named Ray Price. But Freehand did most all the catching there. Rogers was catching at the Angels.
Buck Rogers, right.
He was in the. I was only there about 3 weeks with the Angels. The catchers I had at Houston, Dave Adlich, and I'm trying to think of the guy's name. The big guy that was the other big catcher there.
You know, I know his name now, but I'm.
He writes a lot of bad checks. I'm trying to think of his name. He hit some home runs over there, and good arm, could throw pretty good. But I remember Adlich, Doug Harvey, the umpire, says that he'd just come up in 68, and I'm pitching in San Francisco against Gaylord. And so they're trying to figure who's got the best spitter, you know. But I remember pitching to Hyatt, and Adlich is catching. There's certain guys are just sharp about their catching. And he called for 6 straight sliders, and he took the last one with the bases loaded for the third strike. But Adlich just kept putting it down. He's going to throw him a fastball, you know, and Harvey rung it up. It was a good pitch, but you weren't thinking I didn't get a fastball hit. And we come back to the bench, and I slapped Dave on the knee. You know, he said, yeah, I knew what you wanted to do. You know, so sometimes you get a good rapport with your catcher. Other times, like freehand first, you got to, you know, you've been around, you have to vent some of your, not anger, but you got to say, hey, that's not the way I wanted to.
What was your favorite ballpark to pitch in? You were in both National and American League, so you saw just about every park coming down. And any one in particular that you really liked that was a pitcher's park?
I like the older parks. I like what they're doing. That, you know, Cleveland and Baltimore and Texas have gone back to that. When I was coaching, whatever, I coached at Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And Cincinnati's Riverfront and
the Vet.
They're all symmetrical, all got to be the same. And old Forbes Field, even Crosley Field wasn't a good park to pitch in, but I liked the atmosphere. They were close, right on you. Yeah. One thing about Detroit, there was no foul ball, but when you walked in the ballpark, you know, you got a nice lift. First time I walk into Yankee Stadium, you know, other than the National League Parks, boy, I mean, you get a kick, you get a thrill, you know, you walk in there. The old Philadelphia ballpark.
Connie Mack.
First game.
Yeah, the old St. Louis Park.
Yeah, Sportsman's
Park. And they're like, here's the story. So and so hit one over the clock, and at Detroit, they're telling me about, you know, Ty Cobb, you know, the trainer, Bill Hummel was the trainer. And he said, we're playing the national anthem. He says, you hear him? What? Ty singing the national anthem. He's up on the roof somewhere. I mean, you know, the guys play games, you know, that way, but. I think Dodger Stadium, as far as the park to pitch in, fair and all that. But every park, I think, has its own, you know, an entity. It's its own self, you know. And the guys that play there, and you remember the guys, you know, that you know, I think of Don Hoke, I think of Clemente, I think of Verdon when I see, you know, Pittsburgh, you know. And, I see Maris, I see Malley, you know, each park. Detroit, I think Al Kaline, you know, making plays down the right field line, you know. Cash was very good at catching pop flies. Ball swirled around in Detroit, and in right field was the only place he had a little bit of room.
Right.
Norm run by catch balls over his shoulder, you know, as good as anybody in that ballpark. You see more guys, you know, follow.
Yeah.
A few parks that I didn't like. Cleveland, I just, that to me was depressing. And San Francisco's park, most of the time, you come out of the clubhouse and do a 50-mile-an-hour wind blows your hat off and sand blows up in your eyes. It was just not a fun place to go into. You know, I imagine a lot of those guys didn't enjoy it. You know, that wasn't a good park to really go. Crosley was a tough park. It was a small park to pitch.
It was, very much so. How about Seal Stadium when you first, before they built?
I liked that better.
Yeah, was it?
Yeah.
Not as much wind?
No, it was foggy. It was bald and carry. Mm-hmm. The park was a little bit smaller. Didn't seat enough people. But that was 58, I think 59. In 59 we played there too. That's one of the ironic stories about the three-game series we had there where all the New York writers were in town. This might not be fit for print, though.
Want me to turn it off?
Yeah. I wouldn't do that to put anybody in a bad light.
Alrighty. Lots to talk a little bit now. You just mentioned it earlier that one of the questions we have here talked about spring training and as an older pitcher getting in shape to go down to spring training. How worthwhile is spring training in your mind for, you know, pitchers but, you know, players as a whole? Because we hear a lot of play players saying, we don't need spring training.
Well, I think that there's a certain part of the game that you need to be able to do. I work with younger kids, and you take Cleet Boyer or Brooks Robinson, and you watch them balls hit to their right or to left for them to dive and react and back up, backhand the ball, get up off their knees and throw somebody out. Okay. During the course of the season, he takes 50 to 100 ground balls every day at the ballpark. Just like a golfer, he goes out and hits balls. After they get done, they hit balls, they practice. They do things by muscle memory and reaction. You don't do it by, there's the ball, go get the ball. The ball comes too fast. All the things that you do. So the physical part of the game, you get that reaction, mental muscle memory in as good a shape as you can, so that when the season starts and people are paying money to come see the ballpark, you're ready to play. Now, if you don't want to do that and you want to show the people for 30 days or whatever, a haphazard way of doing it, and that ball over in the hole, you go and you don't get it and goes for a double, you know, and your pitcher gets mad, whatever, or your pitcher's not sharp and he's not ready and he's standing out there while he's walking the ballpark for you and you're doing that, then to me, you're not performing at the top of your game, and that's what you're getting paid for. And that's where the players say, I don't need spring training. They're worried about getting tired in September, you know, that you know, hey, the season's whatever the length it is. So that part of spring training, of getting ready so that you're prepared to play on opening day, I always felt was very important. I see the Dodgers in 55 won 10 or 11 in a row, lost one, won 10 or 21 and one. I mean, the season's over by Labor Day. Certain teams get off and running, you know, and can win a pennant and by getting off to a good start. Can understand guys physically being a little bit tired in September, but that's when you gotta, you know, hitch it up and you do a little bit more. The spring training part, getting your arm in shape for a pitcher,